Hi, my name is James Fulford. That's my real name. The fact that James Kirkpatrick may be a pseudonym may be said to be a violation of what's called the Two Steves rule, where you try not to confuse people at your sitcom by having two different people. James Kirkpatrick is a very energetic writer, very serious writer, occasionally a very angry writer, is very active in the movement and has also written a book. And the book is called Conservatism, Inc., and it's about how lame all those other people are. But he's also got some interesting stuff to say about the future, and I'll have him come up now.
At some point over the last week, a member of the Texas National Guard drowned and is presumed dead trying to rescue some illegal immigrants who were crossing a river. I feel that's a bit too on the nose for the story of the United States of America in the year of our Lord 2022, because it seems that we have a government that is dedicated to the destruction of the nation. We're in a situation now that challenges many of the assumptions of the nation state, because the idea is that a nation is a people, and the government should be the political expression of that people. But right now, the greatest enemy, perhaps the only enemy, the only real enemy that the nation has, is the government. In the government schools, we are taught to despise our own history. The government has said that white supremacists are the greatest terrorist threat. This is very hard to believe when there was a black supremacist who shot up a subway in Brooklyn not too long ago. We had somebody run over six people at a Christmas parade. That was quickly shoved down the memory hole and is barely even a story. Between 2019 and 2020, the homicide rate increased by 30%, according to the FBI, which is the single greatest single-year increase in the FBI's history. These crimes seem to have no significance. The murder rate actually went up even further in 2021 in several major cities. Nobody seems to care, not the mayors, not the huckster preachers, not the federal government, certainly, and not the so-called community. As far as I can tell, they seem to enjoy it. If we consider how things are for the average person, most people who are under 30 are now reconciled to the idea that they will never buy a house, that that is just something that is completely ridiculous and is never going to happen. If you look at, insofar as we can objectively measure these things in terms of happiness, depression, self-reported mental illness, all of these things are increasing among all groups, whites, blacks, straights, gays, Hispanics, women, men, you name it. Antidepressant usage through the roof. In terms of the rule of law, according to the, I believe it's the statistics that we get from the Labor Department, so this is probably on the low end, but they said 11.5 million illegal immigrants in this country right now. To put that in perspective, that's about double the population of everybody in the Baltic states, which of course the United States is now sending more weapons to and pledging to defend against Russia. You'll be happy to know that in the last week, President Biden sent $800 million to Ukraine, $2 billion since the start of his administration. If you want to know where your COVID survival checks went, if you want to know where the money for the wall went, if you want to know where the money so the bridges stop collapsing and the roads don't look terrible, if you want to know where all that went, that's where it went. It probably just got blown up by a Russian missile maybe 20 minutes ago. If we just took piles of money and set it on fire, it would actually be less destructive than what we do now, because at least there would be less chance of us all dying in nuclear hellfire, because the people in charge want to play Risk instead of actually caring about what's happening to people in this country right now. Because we are a people without a nation. We may call ourselves nationalists, but we don't have a nation. And it's important for us to remember that nationalism is not terribly ancient. If we talk about modern nationalism, this really didn't happen until, most would say, the French Revolution. There was certainly the sense of being part of a people. There was certainly the sense of being part of a civilization. There was certainly the sense of being part of an order and having certain values that you looked up to. But the idea of being part of a common people, united by language, united by culture, united by a shared sense of history, united by a shared destiny, which I would say is the most important thing, that's all relatively new. And it is extremely hard to believe that America still has those things. The Washington Post, not too long ago, ran an opinion article that said, Germany has come to terms with its harmful past. Why can't America do the same? This is in regards to slavery. Now, if you're familiar with the German system, we call it part of the free world, but it arrests political dissidents. You're not allowed to say certain things. It bans political parties and supervises them with the domestic spy service. This is all part of what we call liberal democracy. Ukraine, of course, is also another brave liberal democracy where they ban the political parties they don't like and arrest the political opponents of the president. This is also liberal democracy. This is in contrast to Russia, which we are told is authoritarian, because I'm not quite sure what the distinction is. I mean, I think it's just sort of whatever our leaders are saying at any given moment. And that's kind of the biggest thing that we face right now, because when we talk about things like peoples, when we talk about things like nations, when we talk about things like constitutions and the things that we hold sacred, if the last few years have taught us anything, it's that conservatives are wrong when they say human nature is essentially unchangeable. Because the most fundamental aspects of people's personalities, even to the point of their sexuality or of how they define themselves, or what they hold to be sacred, including their religious beliefs, as far as we can tell, can be changed with a few years of sitcoms and late night comedy. For example, Barack Obama, when he ran for president, opposed gay marriage because he said, as a Christian, this was a tenet of his faith. He changed his mind about this a few years down the line. I bring up the former president because he just gave a speech talking about the need for greater censorship to control misinformation online. You may be interested to know that the new censorship excuse just dropped, where they just said Twitter will not accept advertising from organizations that do not accept the consensus, the scientific consensus on climate change. I can't help but wonder what the scientific consensus on racial differences is, and whether groups that claim obviously false things, like groups perform equally on standardized tests, whether those groups should be kicked offline for peddling misinformation. Because as far as a myth that is actually destructive, that actually gets people hurt, that actually gets people killed, that actually divides people in this country, that's the biggest lie of all that I can think of right now. And that's something that's preached by every single institution with power in this country.
Yeah, right.
And I, for one, am not mad at those people who preach that, because their opinions don't matter to me. As a matter of fact, I deny that they even have opinions. They're as flimsy as Barack Obama's supposed Christian beliefs. They're the product of television. They're the product of public relations firms. They're the product of political polls. They're the product of corporate donations. They have no values. They have no opinions. As far as I'm concerned, they have no personality. And according to some polls, they don't even have an internal monologue, which begs the terrifying question of whether they're really conscious at all. There's a deeper question here, too, which is that if information has to be curated because people are too stupid to know what's misinformation and what's not, then what's the premise of democracy? Why do we waste all this time and money? Why not just have the tech CEOs pick our leaders for us and be done with it? It would certainly save us a lot of trouble. I mean, I suppose the people in charge would support that policy until Elon Musk buys Twitter, at which point suddenly the rules will change again. But I'm not mad at the people who we think of as our opponents. I'm not mad at leftists. I'm honestly not mad at Antifa who scream at me. I'm not mad at the heads of the big foundations. I'm not mad at the people who were supposed to be mad at, like the ADL and the SPLC, because they're acting out of role. To get mad at them is to get mad at a dog that barks at you. I mean, it's not worth your consideration, because there's no communication possible. There's nothing to discuss. And this is also why, I suppose in contrast to some of the people here, I just don't believe it's ever worthwhile to speak to journalists, because every journalist knows the story they're going to write before they contact you. If they didn't already know what they were going to say, they wouldn't be bothered to contact you. So, like, I'm not going to try to operate in good faith with a journalist or convince them what I want to say, because I don't try to talk to my dog about tax policy. I mean, it would be just as fruitless. I suppose I should say I just had another son, and so I'm doing my part. Yeah! I'm doing my part. And I would be far more likely to discuss immigration policy with him at a few months old than I would with anybody at the Washington Post. So my anger is not directed at them. My attention is not directed at them. As far as I'm concerned, we shouldn't even complain about them anymore. And the reason I'm going on this now is because I want us to kind of let this stuff go and forget about it. Like the greatest Stoic teaching, if you don't have control over something, you just need to relinquish it and think about the things you do have control over. The people that I'm angry with and the people with whom I hold there is no forgiveness possible, because to see and to speak and not to speak is the great betrayal, are the conservatives. The people like David French who tell us that the American right shouldn't even be called conservative anymore, that we should relinquish that word. Well, you know what, as far as I'm concerned, they can have it. Because let it be said right here, there is nothing under this existing system, nothing, nothing, nothing worth preserving. There is not one institution, there is not one institution that is neutral. The idea that the rule of law, which I think died about 10 million illegal immigrants ago and a couple decades ago, the idea that the Constitution exists in any meaningful sense. I think one of the greatest, it's not even politics, it's just kind of entertainment, was when liberals around the country were very upset because a Trump-appointed judge threw out the mask mandate imposed by the CDC, and they had the nerve to say things like, an unelected judge is setting policy for the entire country, this is very dangerous. Well, where have you been the last half century? Where have you been for every single major social change that's taken place in this country, none of which came through the government as the framers intended it, but came through unelected judges? We have to let go of our illusions. We have to let go of this idea that we still have something to defend. We have to stop trying to save people and institutions who don't want to be saved. Let's take an objective look at our real situation. The 2020 election, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not terribly concerned about election fraud or even really the outcome so much. I think the revolutionary potential of the 2016 Trump campaign, and by revolutionary, I mean things like enforcing laws that were already on the books, which of course is unthinkable under our current system somehow. That was lost very early. That was arguably lost right off the bat with some of the staffing decisions that were made. But the main thing to me that happened with 2020 was it represented state conquest. There was a historic American nation that was vaguely tied to this regime, to this government, something bigger than both political parties. There was a certain narrative of American history that began with the Pilgrims and Jamestown and the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and the settlement of the West, what it means to be an American. And even if your ancestors weren't literally here from 1776, you were brought up to consider these people as your forefathers. Even if it wasn't literally your blood, and for many people it is, even if it wasn't for you, you thought of it in this way. But I would submit that the new intersectional flag, not the rainbow flag, which is, you know, behind the times and I guess racist and fascist now, but the new one with the triangle and the circle and the black and brown for Black Lives Matter and everything else, I think that flag has far more moral importance to the rich and powerful of this country than the United States flag does. If you burn an American flag, it's not even news. You burn that flag, you're probably going to jail for a hate crime. And conservatives are trying to say that this system still exists, that the country still exists, that we can have some sort of a compromise. You saw this when they started tearing down statues, and National Review said, well, it's okay to take down Confederate statues, but it's not okay to take down the statues of the Founding Fathers. Well, guess what? They not only took down the statues of the Founding Fathers, but then they went after Teddy Roosevelt, and in Chicago, they even went after Abraham Lincoln. As a matter of fact, I even think there was a bust of Frederick Douglass that got destroyed. So if we're going that far, you have to ask yourself, what world are people living on where they think that we can discuss these things in good faith? As far as I'm concerned, free speech and the idea of the marketplace of ideas and open discussion and all of that went out the window when we saw big tech censorship, when we saw people being shut down from the public square, when we saw Republicans do nothing about it because they benefit from these censorship programs because it leaves them as the only alternative. As far as I'm concerned, all the discussions and debates have been made. There's nothing more to say. There's only to recognize where we are and to act. We are in a post-American age. And I think the longer that we pretend that the country still exists, the worse the price is that we're going to have to pay. Now let's consider our best case scenario. Best case scenario, something that's probably not going to happen. If the Republicans, despite not deserving it, take back the House, let's say they even take back the Senate, let's say they even, and again, I think it's way, way, way too early to even start talking about 2024, who's gonna be a candidate. Health issues, criminal issues, we just don't know what's going to happen. But let's say whatever Republican candidate of your fantasy and what you think he's going to do, your dark MAGA, whatever, let's say that all happens. Then what? Friends, the horse has already left the barn. I mean, the demographic shift is already in. And if you look at the polls on opposition to immigration, for the first time, you no longer have the people on your side when it comes to stopping immigration. There actually has been a shift in that issue, and it has not been our way. And that's part of the Great Awakening, the massive shift among, and that's Matthew Yglesias. I'm not citing some, well, actually, I think Matthew Yglesias might be considered an alt-right pundit by some people on Twitter, but he's not. Although, we do have to say, and this is kind of an inside joke, but as somebody on Twitter put it, every time Matthew Yglesias says something about crime or statistics, it's like a bat signal, and then Steve Saylor jumps in the replies and starts lecturing him about IQ and something like that. But Matthew Yglesias was, I think, the one who coined this term, the Great Awakening, and that represented a fundamental shift, because you saw massive swings in a very short amount of time on issues surrounding criminal justice and race. So for example, you had, I believe, a 17-point swing from, I think, 2006 to 2015 or so. This is all pre-Trump, on whether black socioeconomic performance is dependent on their own ability or whether it's the fault of white racism. And far more white leftists said that is now the fault of white racism. Well, if you unpack that statement, that means that white racism had actually gotten worse from 2006 or so to 2014 or so while Barack Obama was president. I still recall in those long, long ago days, which seemed like another lifetime, when I was working at a conservative organization, and the day after Barack Obama's election, one of my friends came up to me and put his arm around me and said, "We lost." And I said, "Yeah, well, what are you going to do?" I didn't have the heart to tell him that. I didn't vote for Mitt Romney and voted third party. And he said, "Well, we have a black president now, so at least no one will ever call us racist again." I know many people of goodwill, and I'm not poking fun at them. I think they can be forgiven for thinking this, who voted for Barack Obama because they wanted America to get past race. You hear this kind of language with the immigration debate, too. We're going to get past the immigration debate by passing amnesty. And then somehow it'll be done, and then we can focus on whatever comes next, presumably whatever war we're going to lose next. But you don't get past these issues. You don't get past issues that cut to the core of who constitutes the polity, of who constitutes the nation. These things are with us, and they're going to be with us forever. And there's no way we can just settle it and be done. Even if you have some insane fantasy of having your own homeland and everything is set up the way you want, we're in a castle, maybe we get a king from whatever royal line you want. I know there's some Catholics in here who want to restore the Stuarts. We could do something like that. It still doesn't solve the problem definitively. The idea that there's an end of history, I think, is a fantasy not just of something like the Book of Revelation. I think that actually makes far more sense than Francis Fukuyama predicting the end of history with liberal democracy. Because as we've seen, the peace that comes with liberal democracy fades very quickly, as do all the individual freedoms that we are supposed to have. When it comes to how the government works, when it comes to how power is exercised, about whether you have the right to express opposition to the government in power, about whether you have the right to say what you want on social media, about whether you have the right to control your own property, and deal with only those people who you want to deal with. There is no free world. And it is sickening and obscene when conservatives say that there is one. And it is nothing short of disgusting when they tell people to go out there and fight and die for it. It's a fantasy. It's a lie. And we shouldn't put up with it anymore. Now, another fantasy is this idea that the people are going to react. Now, it's no secret that President Joe Biden is not the most popular man. I can't help but I think I speak for everybody here. I don't hate anybody as a group. Well, journalists, of course, but, you know, they don't count. But as far as groups of people, I think I can roll along with pretty much anybody. And as far as individuals go, I can roll along with pretty much anybody. And I think Joe Biden has the look of a man who's not quite sure how he ended up in this place. Forget the jokes about, oh, he's senile and everything else. I actually don't think that. But I think he may be, but let's give him the benefit of the doubt for a second. I honestly don't think he knows how he ended up in this political environment. I think just today he said, these aren't your father's Republicans, this is the MAGA party now. And the idea that this represents some dramatic shift from what he's dealt with before is very interesting, considering that for most of Joe Biden's career, particularly when it comes to criminal justice, we'd have to say he was to the right of President Trump. He, after all, was one of the leading guys who was pushing the tough on crime policies of the Clinton administration. And I should say the Republican Congress under Newt Gingrich after 1994. When he started his run for president, he said, Donald Trump has more in common with George Wallace than George Washington. Well, I'm pretty sure that George Wallace probably, especially after he renounced his segregationist views and kept getting elected governor of Alabama with lots of black support, I'm pretty sure George Wallace probably had more acceptable views than George Washington did when it comes to certain political and racial issues. But we're in the ruins of this polity that was founded by men like Washington and Jefferson and Madison. And given the current values that we are told to believe in, you cannot reconcile the public religion of our time, the creed of egalitarianism that we are supposed to believe in, you cannot reconcile that with actually existing American history. You cannot reconcile that with what leading historical figures actually said and believed. Right now, when they tear down statues of George Washington or Teddy Roosevelt or whoever else, conservatives have this reaction of, well, you shouldn't do that. But if you ask them why, it's just simply because it makes them uncomfortable. It's a shocking thing. But if you ask them to defend what these men had to say on these sorts of issues, you either are met with silence or outright lies. I don't know about you, but I'm very tired of hearing that Martin Luther King would be a Republican or that he opposed affirmative action. He did not. I'm very tired of hearing that a lot of these other people would supposedly support the Republican Party. They would not. And the leftists who say these things know what they're talking about a lot more than do the editors of something like, say, National Review. I hate to just pick on them, but they're the most spectacular example, considering the kind of separate peace they tried to negotiate with the left during the iconoclasm of 2020 and 2019. It doesn't work that way. We're seeing this, too, on sexual issues, which really aren't the main thing that I'm concerned about, but it's interesting in terms of showing how quickly public opinion can be changed. Guys like Andrew Sullivan are suddenly saying, well, the sexual revolution has gone too far. We went to where I wanted it to go, but now it's time to stop. And we're just going to hold it here. And if you go too far in this direction, then you're undoing everything else. Well, it doesn't work that way. Ideas, unfortunately, get taken to their logical conclusion. And that's one of the biggest problems that we have to deal with, because people are ceding ground in arguments that once you cede it, you're inviting everything else that follows. The reason we have to talk about things that, frankly, I don't want to talk about all the time, and which are uninteresting if that's all you talk about, but the reason we have to talk about things like racial differences is because if you don't, you don't have an explanation why you have different performances across groups. And if you don't have an explanation, the only explanation left is white racism. And if you believe that, then how can you oppose in good conscience things like reparations? How can you oppose redistribution of wealth? What ground do you have for saying that these traditional American heroes should be protected when these people are saying they're responsible for all their problems? Yeah. What do you end up with? You end up with brain-dead Republicans saying MLK was a Republican. Well, he's not. And we've been doing this for decades. And for those people who worked in the conservative movement for a very long time and who made these kinds of mistakes, particularly in the 90s when there was a real chance of turning all this back, I think we can feel bitterness, but I'm willing to say they didn't know what they were doing. Maybe that's naive of me. I'm willing to say that maybe they didn't know fully what they were unleashing. Types of people who voted for the 1965 Immigration Act, the type of people like Newt Gingrich who didn't stop affirmative action when it could have been stopped, the types of people in the like Paul Ryan who could have stopped immigration in 2016. Maybe they're just naive. But I think after 2019 and 2020, when you have leading institutions openly saying the historic American nation is evil and we need to replace it, when you have people pointing to Germany, where Germans are brought up from birth to regard their national history as nothing but something to be ashamed of and something that they need to renounce and then to welcome their own extinction. When you have the most powerful people in our country saying, this is the model that we need to follow, that America needs to be treated like a conquered nation, At this point, there can be no more illusions. And at this point, if we continue to go along with these illusions, then we are a conquered nation. And if we are a conquered nation and we go along with this any longer, then frankly, we deserve our fate. This country was founded by people who rejected the orders that they were given. They said that there is something deeper, that there is something more important than our oath to the king or our historic ties to Great Britain. For Thomas Jefferson, the things that he thought were important were their traditional liberties that he found in the Anglo-Saxon people. And he had all sorts of writings about how our liberties don't just come from nature, but actually come from the long history of our people extending back to the British Isles. All of the people who were great in American history, they didn't just base their patriotism and ideas on abstractions. They based it on historic experience. They pointed to specific people who they could say, these are our forefathers, and they did these things. And that's where our liberties come from, and that's where our identity comes from, and that's what we're fighting for. Even Abraham Lincoln, whatever you think about the war between the states, when he said, our forefathers brought forth on this continent a new nation, even Lincoln would be regarded as wildly out of the realm of acceptable opinion because of the things he said. Because even Lincoln recognized the link between his movement then and the founders. That link has been severed now. Right now, the current American government, and if you don't believe me, look at the books in your children's public schools, look at the editorials in our leading newspapers, look at the content moderation policies on social media, which increasingly determine election outcomes. Right now, the current American government is premised upon the explicit rejection of the nation that came before. The closest thing I can think of is South Africa, where a new regime took power and it justified itself in the name of we are undoing that which came before. It's also not surprising that quite a few leftists have argued for truth and reconciliation committees for the United States, in which we would investigate all these different things, hold people accountable, come up with all sorts of fun new reparation schemes and everything else. All of this is coming. And the Republicans have no answer to it. It's not that I'm faulting them because they won't fight. I mean, they actually will fight in some kind of uncoordinated way. But it's that they have no serious arguments why they should resist these things. They've been stripped of the vocabulary of how you can push back against these things. It's our job not just to fight, but to tell people why it's not just morally acceptable, but morally incumbent upon people to fight back. That we actually don't have to go along with this stuff just because people with money and power say we do. You know, some people online have taken to calling the current regime the global American empire. I don't like that term only because I don't like giving them the term American. That's our word, as some people say. We're allowed to use that word, they're not. I usually use Potomac regime, but there is something foreign about that city on the Potomac. And I say that as somebody who lived there for quite a long time. There's something, I don't know, almost uncanny and horrific, something lying behind everything else there. And when you see these wild conspiracy theories, and when you see some ridiculous claims made about public figures, frankly, I don't believe in any of these things, but I think even those, even the most outrageous conspiracy theories, are actually less horrifying than the truth. And the truth is that the people who rule us, it's not that they're indifferent to us, it's that they really do want us gone. They know what they're doing. Everything that's happening is not an accident. And they're doing it on purpose. And we don't need to create ridiculous conspiracies about why they're doing this. We don't need to come up with 100-year plans about, like, oh, a guy wrote a book 100 years ago and they're following it now. All we have to do is look at the statements that they're saying now. All we have to do is look at what they're saying in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, or for that matter, coming from the Biden White House. And I think while Joe Biden himself is kind of hapless and doesn't really know what's happening, I think that his staffers know exactly what they're doing. And they're the ones who are actually pushing through policies in a very tragic reversal of what happened with President Trump, where President Trump had thousands of people who would have worked for him and rather be burned alive than so much as speak to a reporter. And unfortunately, they outsourced staffing to the normal Republican establishment, and he was sabotaged from day one. Now, we can pin that on him. We can pin that, ultimately, it is his fault. But that we can't just keep looking back to 2016. We have to recognize where we are now. And where we are now, frankly, is not a good place. Because I think that the best we can do with the existing system is staunch the bleeding. But within that system, we can make certain demands, and I insist that we frame them as demands, as things that we are entitled to, not as policy suggestions. And if America really is the liberal democracy that they claim it is, if this really is a free government, if this really is something different than this authoritarianism that they want us to fight and die for, die fighting against all over the world, then we'll see. First and most importantly is we need to insist on the absolute enforcement of all currently existing immigration laws. Every single illegal in this country needs to go. Every single one, no exceptions. And until that happens, I don't want to hear about the Constitution. I don't want to hear about the rule of law. I don't want to hear about a rules-based international order. None of these things exist. This is nonsense. And it should be greeted with contemptuous laughter, not even a debate. The second thing is we need to scrap affirmative action, all of it. And I was looking at how this would play out with something like Harvard, if they only admitted the top 10% of students. Interestingly enough, you would actually see a reduction in the white student population. You'd see a pretty dramatic increase in the Asian student population, and you'd see a reduction in black student population. Now, there are some things when it comes to race that, frankly, I don't like. If I look at all the data that I've seen, it seems clear that Asian Americans earn more and do better on educational tests than white Americans do. That doesn't make me feel great. I don't have some sense of superiority about it because obviously it's not reflected in the data, but that's just the way the world is. And if we aren't willing to deal with facts that make us uncomfortable, then we're not really growing up. I mean, part of what being an adult is dealing with the world as it is and not how you would want it. And the fact that for the last 60, 70 years, we've descended into childlike fantasy, or really catering to the fantasies of people, has led us to the brink of disaster. Which brings me to my third point, which is reparations. And I think we need to flip the script on this, because I think we're the ones who are owed reparations. And I don't need some crazy commission to say, well, 300 years ago this happened, and then, you know, in Tulsa they bombed it for no reason, and now we're owed all this stuff. All I have to do is point to the cities all around this country, the infrastructure that's been destroyed, the streets that look like something out of Ukraine. As a matter of fact, if you look at just what's happened in the last few years, just the property destruction from that alone, how many small businesses have been utterly ruined? How many people have been killed and have their lives destroyed to the contemptuous laughter of journalists who think that the biggest problem is that police exist? How many people went out there to express their First Amendment rights, or what they thought were their First Amendment rights, and then suddenly discovered that the rules don't apply equally for all sides, that the left can burn and beat and attack, and it's no problem. But if you're walking through Congress, staying in between the little ropes in Statuary Hall, you're going to jail for a very long time. This kind of anarcho-tyranny, this kind of selective law enforcement, this kind of hypocrisy, it's not something we can just complain about anymore. Because anyone who is capable of seeing that it exists has already seen it. There's nothing more to say. There's just a question of what is to be done. Now, as to that question, I am of the opinion that you can't go back. I am of the opinion that any attempt to create or go back to the Constitution or the United States as it should have been or could have been or whatever else is somewhat doomed to failure. I think some of the problems with our Constitution, one is they dramatically underestimated the power of the judicial branch, which is really how the left has won its greatest victories, by judicial fiat. And they didn't anticipate the regulatory state, which, as we learned with the Trump administration, that's where the power really seems to lie. And I don't really see a way that you're going to be able to scrap all of those bodies. Remember, it was President Reagan who ran on getting rid of something like the Department of Education. And at the end of the day, I think it had a higher budget than when he came in. And that was in much more favorable political conditions with a very popular president, at least for the second term. So what can we do? Well, I'm not going to say LARP and create your own fantasy nation and then run around trying to make it happen. I'm not going to say that we need to embrace some extreme ideology or extreme tactics. As a matter of fact, I would say a lot of that is counterproductive. But what I would say is that you have to either start from where you are, and if you can't start from where you are, you do actually have to move to places where you can do something productive. The way to think of our people is occupied. But occupied peoples can resist. We can build parallel economies. We can build networks. We can build things that are outside, that are not in the mainstream economy, because frankly, the mainstream economy is closed to us, as close to us as the central planning economy of the Soviet Union was. I'm going to close with this, and it's not something that I want you to just listen to or clap. I want you to just think about it and what it means in practical terms. Because the hardest part about this is it's not the kind of thing that we can really discuss publicly. Because a lot of what you're doing are the kinds of private arrangements so you can survive in this hostile system. And you don't need to broadcast to the world what you're doing. There are three ways that you can have a group. One is based on ideology. I don't think that's going to work, because then when you have an ideological dispute, the group breaks up. Another is money. We don't have a Ford Foundation. You're not going to be able to just pay people to be on your side. The third and the strongest thing, and I've seen this in my own experience, is it has to be something that is built on something deeper than just a social bond, deeper even than just a religious bond. It has to be a bond of brotherhood. It has to be a bond of social solidarity where you say that the people next to you are more important than you yourself. Where you have a willingness to sacrifice, not for an abstraction, but for the people to the left and right of you. That's the kind of spirit that we need. That's the kind of spirit that I see in some of you, and that's the kind of spirit that I've seen in people who are doing this all across this country. And if enough of us develop that kind of spirit, and if enough of us are willing to do what needs to be done, and if enough of us start doing the kinds of things where you don't need to wait for a collapse or some extreme crazy political situation, but do the kind of things that will make your life better right now, regardless of what's happening in the outside world, if we do those things, we will have something greater than just restoring our country. We'll have a country of our own. We'll have a country that will move past the failures of our history, and we'll have something that pursues greatness instead of the false idol of equality. Thank you. Thanks, guys.